You are welcome. Everybody is welcome here amongst us. I wish to apologize because I was supposed to start at 9, but we'll call about 9 now. I understand that the members got lost on the day. Even myself, I went to 90 Plain Street. It was for Colisa, because Colisa was just on the other side. I don't know what went wrong. Maybe there was a civil war this morning. That's what I got lost. Otherwise, you are welcome. Our agenda is too short today. We are going to receive a presentation from the department, from this unit that is called Housing Development Agency, on the progress that they have made since their inception. I think their inception, in fact, they started operating last year in April. So, as the responsibility of the portfolio committee, we have to play oversight quarterly. We need quarterly reports from the department, from the various units. But I must be honest, since last year, we have not done so because it was our first year of the term. So we were so overloaded with everything that is new and the new regulations, new rules, and there was quite a lot of work. So I want to send the message to the department to say now, starting this year, we're going to stick to our quarterly report, because if we don't do that, we are going to have a problem. That is why we find ourselves at the end of the year. We find that there are so many problems that should have been addressed, but they have not yet been addressed because we took a long time to check what is going on within the department. And then we are going to have a briefing by the Legal Services Unit after this presentation. And then on the Section 231 of the Constitution, it relates to the MOUs. So I wish to hand over. Okay, before I call Honorable Foreman, I've done the opening and welcome. Do we have any apologies? Secretary?
I have one for Mr. Stain and Mr. Makulua.
Mr. Stain and Mr. Makulua, we accept the apology. Honorable Foreman, are you accepting? I can see you are nodding. Who's seconding? Honorable Fickland.
Thank you.
I saw your hand, Honorable Foreman.
I'm working.
Is it not working?
Is it not? This
one is working.
Do this one.
Okay. Chairperson, I just would like to ask why we did not receive these documents in good time from the department, from the HDA. We are really needing to take this work very seriously of oversight. And we cannot be expected to come in here and just see a presentation and then not ask the proper sort of questions that we need to ask. We have a huge problem out there, Chair. And we've been out there now several times. We've just been out with the Ad Hoc Committee on Service Delivery. And the land issues and the housing issues are huge out there. Now, I don't know why we did not get documents. This meeting was actually scheduled for the 24th or the 23rd or 24th of the month. I can't see any reason why we did not get the documents, but perhaps the department could explain to us. And I really do want to suggest that if we don't have documents given to us in good time, that we actually do not entertain the presentation, because we cannot be expected to to intelligently oversee this kind of thing?
Thank you very much, Honorable. Honorable Sweep, I can see him to be followed by Honorable Big Land, to be followed by Honorable Bula Machoba.
Chair, I agree that accepting the sentiment raised by expressed by Honorable Boma. And I think we should really encourage the department to do that, give us the documentation on time. I really accept that. But I want to make an appeal that because we are here, that we should allow the presentation to go ahead. And then if there are matters that we need time to look at them, then we can then call the department back. But as a principle, I think we should say that really, that 5 days before the meeting, we need every information. Because we must read it, do this, otherwise our oversight function is going to be very futile if we don't do thorough research in ourselves before we come and interact with them. Also, I think it's very good for a department also to interact really with a well-informed committee rather than really to do that. But I'm making just a request that because we are here now, it would be a good idea for us to have a presentation. And we can then call them back if there are real difficult questions that we can ask. The point really that we have been visiting the provinces, there are a lot of problems that we may want to pose, even if it really we did get the document today. And hopefully that the presenters are going to assist us with some discussion. Really, I support your expression, but I want to appeal that the meeting do continue, and then we shouldn't deal with another issue there.
Thank you very much, Comrade Richards. Honorable Big Land.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think my mic doesn't want to work in the territory time. Actually, I just want to support my colleagues on what they're saying now, because we are here as government. Now, if you look around each and every day in the news, it shows that we don't deliver. There's a mess down there. Now, if we fail as this portfolio because of this presentation coming at the last minute, it's very bad. It looks very bad. But I will echo with the Chief Whip that we carry on with the meeting and then we can ask those questions we can. But this must never happen again. Thank you, Chair.
I think the
Yeah, no, thank you, Chairperson. I think the matter has been addressed adequately.
Yeah.
But I also strongly believe that we don't want to cast aspersions on the character and the credibility of the department. But if my memory reads correct, I think sometimes we have made the very same request to the very same department that this matter should not be repeated. And we once again we take exceptions to this kind of behavior.
I thought I'm going to differ with my colleague, but now then it's 1, 2, 3 against and two. I had swallow my pride now. Yeah, because this is not, otherwise to be honest with ourselves, there's no contribution you're going to get from us now. We can just listen to you. Even to ask questions, it should be just a full-time exercise. You can just listen to what you're saying, and then we say, no, next time we must rearrange another meeting. It can't be. We are not honest in ourselves. Besides, we're all honest to you. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. I think the... oh, man.
That's ever mind, but I've got to big enough with. You know, this is a democracy and we have to go with the majority. But I do want to say that this is not the first time we sat around this table spending the opening and then we give in at the end. And I strongly believe that today we should not be doing that. But obviously, if that's the majority feeling, then I will go with that. But we seemingly are not able to get our message through that we need these documents beforehand so that we can properly interrogate this thing and do our oversight. That's all we are trying to do. So, Chairperson, I feel strongly about that, but obviously I'm not with the majority in this democracy.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members.
I think with Honourable Bowman.
Okay, fine. I think we can give the department the opportunity, but I want to say I'm very disappointed by what the department is doing. We had a workshop at least to try to make sure that we understand each other in December. And it was put forward that at least the portfolio committee must receive the document first, because the department, this is their daily work. That is what they are appointed for to do. Now, if they cannot do that, because the members, they are not serving into one committee. They are serving into several committees, even worse during this term, because the membership has shrunk. Now, what is going on? You will find that the member is serving to another committee. So they have got quite a lot of documents to read. Now, if you bring these documents, they are not going to be play their oversight optimally. So we appeal to the department. We say 5 days, if the latest is 3 days. And what I'm disappointed with, I made an effort. On Friday, I requested the document so that at least the latest they can receive, the members should receive. And then on Monday, I contacted Mr. Labat to remind the HDA to bring the documents. And he came back to me and said he has spoken to them. So that is why I'm saying I'm disappointed. So we really, really appeal. This thing must not happen again. And I think the proper thing, we have to report this to the minister, because saying these things repeatedly, let's report to the minister so that he must understand that we are not being taken seriously, really. But we must give the opportunity to the department.
Over to you.
Chair, it is myself, Maurice Ngomezulu.
Okay.
We, as a department, we have noted your displeasure as a committee. We want to also register our apology and promise this committee that from our side we will try and observe the 5-day listing deadline. Having said so, I think let me allow my colleagues from the HDA, the CEO, to proceed with the presentation as requested by the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I think your apologies are accepted. Over to you, CEO.
Yeah, I want to say to Mbaba Mgomezulu that I think you may have got it. Yeah, if you're not an IAC, you can't accept it.
Okay.
Because I think that would be a problem. Mbaba Mgomezulu, I don't think he knows that. What was that? What was that? What was
that?
Thank you, Chair. For those who we have not yet met before, my name is Taffy Adler, and I'm the CEO of the HDA. I have around me the senior management team of the HDA. Starting from that side over there is Neville Cheney, who is responsible for intergovernmental relations, Keith Govender, who is responsible for communications, Osana Muller sitting next to me, who is our CFO, Joseph Leshabani, on her right, who is responsible for land, and Odette Cofton on his right, who is responsible for programs and projects. I feel a little bit like a meat in a sandwich at this point in time, Chair, because it's not a auspicious way to start a presentation. I do want to assure you that a lot of time and effort and work has gone into trying to give to you the essence of what you were looking for. I think the first time you've spoken directly to us about documents being in time. We do have another engagement on the 17th of March, and I hope you won't have occasion to make the same comments at that time. What we have done in the course of this presentation, Chair, is to cover four elements. The first element is relating to, just to give a background, given that the committee and ourselves are relatively new in this, around the objectives as captured in the Act. I understand that this room is very historical in terms of the Act, because this was the room in which the final draft of the Act was passed. A little bit of controversy, I understand, with the NCLP, but nevertheless it was passed here and then went forward to Parliament. So there is some history to this room as far as the HGA is concerned. So a recap of our objectives and functions, then a look at our institutional development, then at some of the programs and activities, and finally, Chair, we've thought very carefully about this last item, because we want to believe that you are not only charged with oversight, but also with support. And we want to share with you some of the challenges that we face and look for your advice in how we deal with those. So that's the basis on which we would like to establish our interaction with the committee. And as I say, the way we started was not a great introduction to that. I hope in the course of the presentation and the years going forward, we will do better than that. This slide just covers the overall objectives of the HDA as captured in an Act of Parliament. Firstly, and most importantly, to identify, acquire, hold, develop, and release state, communal, and privately owned land for residential and community purposes, and for the creation of sustainable human settlements. And obviously what one's trying to do there is move out of the housing arena into the human settlement arena, as has been the wish of Parliament. Secondly, to project manage human settlement development services for the purposes of creating human settlements. Then to monitor central coordinated planning and budgeting of all infrastructure. And you will be aware that this is one of the major blockages in the country at the moment, is in particular funding, planning, and establishment of bulk infrastructure. And finally, to monitor the provision of all infrastructure required for housing development. So those are broad overall aims as established by the Act. We've translated that into three particular functions in the HDA. The first is land assembly, with those two particular areas of activity. Secondly, delivery support services to organs of state, in particular provinces and municipalities. It'll come up a bit later as to how that's panning out in our interactions with those provinces. And finally, to deal with monitoring and facilitation. We have, since our last meeting in June, come to a establishment of a vision and a mission, and those are the two statements that you have before you. As our vision, we now see sustainable human settlements and communities developed on land and landed properties made available by the HDA, and our mission is as a public development agency that promotes sustainable communities by making available well-located and appropriately planned land. And of course, it's those two last terms that are easy to say but difficult to get going, primarily because of a whole range of legacies and practices in the country as a whole. Firstly, it's trying to overcome spatial difficulties because of our past around trying to put land, make available land that is well located, and secondly, to ensure that the land is properly planned at a whole variety of levels so that we don't get some of the consequences that we all know so well. We are required specifically by the Act to engage in a mandate with the minister. We have envisaged doing that with the permission of the minister by the end of this month. We have been in consultation with various provinces and metropolitan municipalities, and while the formal documentation has still to be developed, the areas that most of our colleagues in the provinces and the metros are indicating is that clearly land identification, acquisition, holding, assembly and release is their priority, and their priority for us. All of them see informal settlement upgrading and formalization as a very important part, which is where not only the land acquisition but the project management elements come into place. I've already mentioned that bulk services, planning, funding and provision. You can go around the country at the moment and everybody will say to you projects are either being held up or being thwarted because there isn't the money available for the upgrading or the establishment of new bulk services. And finally, project and program planning, structuring and strategic support, again, as a major part. So those four points are probably what you will see in formal documentation by the end of this month as our final mandate. Very important to talk about money and funding. The ATA Act gives us those elements of authority to acquire funding. Money appropriated by Parliament, donations received by the agency with the approval of the minister, interest on investments, loans, proceeds from the sale of land, fees for services rendered, and subsidies and grants by organs of state. We must make the point that at this point in time, which is our first budget year and going into the next budget year now, only money appropriated by Parliament is available, and as I will make the point later on, that's only working capital. It's not with working funding, not capital available for the acquisition of land. To move to the next area is just the institutional development. The Act was passed in September 2008. The announcement of the appointment of the CEO and CFO took place in January 2009. The board was inaugurated in February. In March, we actually had the launch, and we were listed as a 3A entity. In April, the plan was formulated, and the finance person took office first. Roxana came into office then. Actually, Intergovernmental Relations came in at the same time, and the CEO and the board finally assumed office in May 2009. So from a kind of kickoff point of view, we're talking about less than a year, and while that's I just want the committee to be in mind as we go forward. That's the organizational structure as we have currently developed it and are in the process of enacting. You will see that at the top or the second line of boxes is where the major areas of activity are. Clearly, finance, intergovernmental relations and stakeholder management, land acquisition management, projects and programs, and then corporate services. So we are in the process of establishing that staffing complement. It's almost there with new people starting almost on a monthly basis at this point in time. We currently have we currently have 55 staff members, of whom the vast majority are in a managerial or professional capacity. I just want to make that point because a point that is often made is that how do you entrust major projects, hundreds of millions of rand, to a newly established entity? And we have been working quite hard to make sure that the people that we've brought in are people with the requisite competence to make sure that we go in the right direction with the appropriate skills. We have also managed to do that within a gender and employment equity framework which satisfies the requirements of Parliament and the country as a whole. These are just some pictures about, we do have a little bit of fun. There was a staff party. We've been doing quite a lot of training and building up teams. And I must just also indicate that we have worked in, we now have three offices, Johannesburg, where our head office is located, Cape Town and Port Elizabeth, where the two projects teams dealing with the two priority projects, namely Bunambula and the N2, are located. And a lot of work has had to go into building up those teams, putting them into the right management frameworks, re-engineering what they do, improving their competencies. All those sorts of things have been working very well, and we've been working very hard to do that over time. From a financial point of view, our last financial year, the one that's just coming to a conclusion now, we were allocated $49.6 million. Operational expenditure as of December was $35.6 million, and again to make the point that there was no capital allocation to the HBA for the 2009-2010 financial year. From a governance point of view, the governing board is obviously the accounting authority. The board has met six times, and there is a list of the procedures that we have approved, the various policies, etc. So from a governance point of view, we think we are in excellent shape, actually. And we have land transactions relating to approximately 2,000 hectares awaiting finalization of feasibility studies and a whole range of agreements that need to be put in place before we can actually take up and develop those lands, that land. Audit and remuneration committees have been established and are fully functional. We have a land and development committee, which was recently established. Internal auditors were appointed as far back as May last year. In February, we got final approval of Ernst & Young as our auditors. That was approved by the Auditor General. And we have been in regular interaction with the Office of the Auditor General. It's been a very good interaction. And at this point in time, they are satisfied with the way in which we are operating. That's a pictorial depiction of the board, just to make the point that there are three other ministers and ministries, departments involved in our work, Public Works, COCTA, and Rural Development. And the balance of the board are appointees of the Minister of Human Settlements. And all of those have been working quite hard. We've had very good relationships with the other departments, all of whom have expressed an interest and support for our work. And as you'll see a little bit later, there are agreements being discussed and negotiated with those departments with the active support of our board members. The biggest project that we have potentially in our books is the project in Cornubia, which is part of a program run by the Itchigwini local authority, municipal authority. The modus vivendi there was that, just to give you an indication of the way in which we're working, was a negotiation with the Metro and the provincial authority, which managed to facilitate land being acquired and transferred to the local authority from, in this case, a private developer, Tomar Hewlett. It's now in the hands of the Metro. The Metro is in the process of developing the plans for what would be a huge development, anything up to how many units? 25,000 units over a period. But it's the land that goes all the way from Mstanga up to Berila. So it's a massive piece of land. It could easily become one of the largest projects, if not the largest project in the country today. Driven by the Metro with the support of the province and national, with an HGA facilitation involvement, including the support for project managers and planning in that development. From the point of view of programs and activities, which together with land form the two legs, if you like, of the HDA. And in firstly setting up the framework within which we operate. We have now intergovernmental protocol agreements with the Northern Cape. We are in the process of finalizing and signing off agreements with land reform, public works, and public enterprises. And those agreements will then open the way for us to start acquiring land and transferring land from those departments into the HDA for further use for human settlement. In relation to land, and this was a priority project that was announced when the HDA was launched, which is why it's mentioned here, for the Lepalale project, that land is subject to a further agreement with Limpopo, who have asked that the land be transferred back to them. So Tubulisha and Limpopo are in the process of finalizing that, and once they've done that, Limpopo has said they would come to talk to us again. We have an agreement and a funding agreement with KZN and Etegwini. Our first priority development area, which is a requirement into or a possibility in terms of our Act, it's a very exciting provision in terms of the Act, is now being finalized with Ekurhuleni in respect of the area, the central area around Germiston, and that would make a very exciting development, which will allow us to bring back a whole range of regulatory suggestions around how we do what we're calling a priority development area. We are hopefully on Monday signing the agreement with the Eastern Cape. There is still a need, and this has gone on for some time now, to finalize the transfer of properties between ServCon and Transnet, and we've asked the National Department to support that. And once that is done, another of the priority projects that we mentioned at the launch of the HDA, which was the inner city development project in the inner city of Johannesburg, awaits the finalization of that particular project. The N2 Gateway Implementation Protocol is currently under discussion. You more than many others will be aware of the kind of difficulties of bringing that to conclusion with all the parties involved, but it has been going quite well, and we're hoping to finalize it in the course of this month. And then we've been talking to various provinces about what they require in terms of land acquisition and assembly. As far as land acquisition management is concerned, again, to make the point that the staffing of that only commenced in September, and only this month, I'm talking about the 1st of March, did the three other managerial posts where they filled. So we really are in the starting blocks on this one. We've determined a business model. We have looked at how you develop criteria, and we're talking to the provinces about that. We are processing a number of land offers, and we are vigorously now trying to address the acquisition of the Transnet properties and the ServCon portfolio. I mentioned that we're involved in discussions with those departments, Public Works, Rural Development, and a variety of state owned enterprises, all of whom own very strategically located land. We have been talking to the various municipalities about how we assist them to acquire land. We have begun the development of a national land inventory with the use of fairly high spec technical innovations, and then we hold or are successor in title to 161 properties either in the Western Cape or properties acquired by ServCon. So in total we have access to about 2,000 hectares at this point in time, which would probably give us, if you take into account all the other services etc. that need to be provided, probably give us about 75,000 units. And if you then look at that against the commitment by the President and the President was made in his speech and also then followed up in the Minister of Finance speech, we're looking at 6,000 hectares. We need to finalize around 2,000 and then we're looking for another 4,000. At the level of projects, the N2 Gateway and Zanambula, which we've been working on very hard. It's probably been one of the major activities since our inception. We've generally strengthened governance on site. There are steering committees meeting there. I think I can safely say that in the case of the N2 and Cape Town, there's been a dramatic improvement in the interactions between the three spheres of government in the steering committee, and a dramatic improvement in the management of the project on site, which then has an impact on the planning and execution of the project. We are still waiting for the final signing of a project management agreement in that case, and similarly in both N2 and Zambula, those agreements have not yet been finalized, and it's taken a long time to do that. And we have approximately 40 project staff that we have taken over from Tubulisha in this case, who started under new conditions of service under the HDA. Northern Cape informal settlement upgrade program sits in very well with the national priorities that have been expressed by the minister, where we've assisted the Northern Cape province with land acquisition, fund mobilization for 2 mega projects in the area, and the planning and implementation of support to the Soil Plant Team municipality, as well as recruiting specialist services to support the province in the development of its 5-year business plan. We must make the point again and again that we work as a service agency to the major developer, who in this case would be the local or the provincial authorities, and it's a framework that we have worked on and are working quite hard to ensure happens. Let me move now, Madam Chair, to looking at the whole question of challenges and some actions that are required. We were established in the main to deal with the problem of availability of land. Quite frankly, if we don't have the capital to do that, then our legs are cut off from us. And we still have to find a funding framework for capital allocation for land identification, acquisition, assembly, and planning. That's not yet in place. We are in discussion with the support of the Department of National Treasury. Obviously, we were not party to that discussion in the first budget cycle, which is just concluded. We are not in a position to, we do not have a capital allocation for this coming financial year, but we are working quite hard to make sure that the year after that, we will overcome that particular problem. We did, in the course of 2009, talk to various provinces and municipalities, and they indicated land acquisition requirements to the value of 1.3 billion rand. Again, that was part of the submissions and discussions that we've been having with the National Department and National Treasury. And in the course of 2010, as I said, ahead of the budget process for 11-12, we will be presenting an operating model. You know, at one level, one is saying we do need that funding. And another level, you can understand that we're a small Manyano little organization. We need to establish our bona fides before people will trust us with that kind of money. We're hoping for a halfway mark, so 500 million would have been nice. But nevertheless, this is where we're sitting at this point in time. And what we're looking for is a predetermined share of the integrated housing and settlement development grant for land identification and planning, etc. We have for some months now had all these agreements in place awaiting approval, and the delays are attributed to internal departmental processes, changing in officials, having to work through again and again the process, the reason, the motivation, etc. And then on the priority projects, while at the level of the project, I think I can safely say that there has been a major shift in the way in which these projects operate. Nevertheless, the technical and legal handovers have not yet been finalized because of administrative delays. Some of the issues that one wants to talk about, and I mentioned this in our last meeting with June, was that the issue of what you pay for state-owned land, whether it's owned by the state or whether it's owned by a state-owned enterprise, the whole question of do you have to pay, what's the value of that land, should one government organ be paying another government organ? And probably that's only going to be reviewed at the higher level or settled at the higher level. As we said then, our view is that the land should, particularly to an agency like the HDA, which is not operating under the for-profit principle, we should be treated as other agencies and therefore get the land for free, or at least at historic cost. We are looking at, and I made this point before, at the issue of resources and capacity. At the moment, we are still in the process of negotiating what the extent of our developments would be in different provinces. We currently have 3 offices. We will look to more as the need requires. We can upscale our capacity in response to demand. We are very aware of the need not to have idle capacity and therefore would want to wait until demand comes through before we do upscale. Again, to make the point that we exist to support municipalities and provinces and not compete with them. And therefore, we will structure our operations in accordance with our funding envelope. I think, Chair, if one were to ask, even in the small period that we've been operating, have we made a difference? I would hope that the answer from those that we've been working with in Kunubia and Etekwini would answer yes. In PE and Zanambula would answer yes. In the Western Cape, around the N2, would answer yes. In the Northern Province, in relation to the informal settlement upgrade program. So the very defined areas where we have been working, we think we have begun to make the difference, but it's very much the start. And we would leave it to them to confirm that. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. CEO, I'm going to hand over to the members for interaction. Honorable Gomen to be followed by Honorable Lagude, to be followed by Honorable Richard, Honorable Bamugwanya, Honorable Fitlan, Honorable Mamunjobe, and you two? Okay, you are the last one. Mambume.
We're doing a sharing exercise with the whole group. Chairperson, I think the first thing I need to say, because I started off in such a negative way, is thank you very much. That was, I'm thrilled with the planning and the progress that seemingly is made. But I also need to say that very often it looks very good on the screen. We actually need to get on the ground to assess for ourselves. I want to also just add that Kunubia is particularly close to my heart because it was one of the last things I did in Etekwini with the rezoning of the land. I was on that particular committee. So perhaps I could just start there with the somewhere I picked up that, and we're talking about integrated human settlements here and the integrated development. And I know that with the huge backlogs from the informal settlements, there is an inclination maybe to say that all the RDP, all the excess, you know, we're going to be developing these RDP houses out there. And I just want to know, what the somewhere I picked up that the first phase of this is going to be 5,000 RDP houses going out there. So I would just like to have some indication there. The other thing I would like to know is that obviously as we've been out there, land, and housing is a real big problem for us. And the backlogs in the informal settlements, which are which is a priority for us. And when you see the conditions, you can understand that. Our metros have, and I know in Edikweni it was the same, we kind of fixed ourselves that in 2014 we were going to have it all cleared up, but realistically that is not the case. And I want to know whether you've done any planning. Last week in the Western Cape, we had backlogs here of 400,000, with 18 to 20,000 coming in per year into these settlements. So, and what is the time frame? Because people are growing up in these informal settlements. They then are becoming themselves ready to qualify for housing. How's the planning so that we actually are getting on top of that? And then perhaps to just on the funding issue, the last time you spoke to us, there was a bit of a problem with funding going through the provinces. I'm not understanding quite clearly. You get some funding from Parliament for your working arrangements. Is the funding still flowing through the provinces? I just want to understand that for you to be able to have access. Or is there just no funding for land, and that's where you're at the moment to acquire land? And I think that is very problematic, and we certainly need to get behind you there for the funding. And then perhaps a little bit more mundane, if I may just be allowed another two questions regarding the board. I haven't been able to pick up how many people serve on your board, and then just finally, the remuneration of your top structure, that we don't end up with things in the paper coming out with huge benefits. What is your lean mean sort of structure remuneration packages for your top structures? And I'm pleased to hear that you're employing competent people into the jobs. That's really a move in the right direction. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you very much. I'm going to apply a principle of training. It's not like we all have the opportunity. Honorable Labute.
Thank you, Chairperson. My other questions have been covered by Honorable Borman. But what I have in mind is that on your program, you are only focusing on the informal settlements. What about those people who are in deep rural areas under the chief? What are your plans for them? And another question is that what about those people who are retrenched, but they've already started building their own houses? What plans do you have for them? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Richard.
Thank you, Chair. And, I think Bowman has taken a lot of some of the issues. First, I might just echo Konati. I think the presentation is very useful. It's very brief and also very clear. I think it's a useful exercise for us. The one issue that I think that we should be dealing with, Chair, is a policy matter around government selling property to another government. I think at the principal level, ourselves as members of committees, because we are policymakers, I think we must have a thorough discussion with the minister. Possible, I think, with the MECs, because I do think that naturally, I think government to government really shouldn't be a transaction. I think it would be a very wrong way of doing things, and I guess that's what I think our staff should be assisting them and give them support on that area. One area also that I think that is, I think we are very happy with the Pula development. Pula, I think it's a new development there. 2,000 hectares, town has to also as well. And then I do think that we should, as a committee, share just visit some of the areas ourselves. The ones that started really working on this thing. Sometimes it's far easier when you are in the area. You can also give a clear picture of what type of development it could happen. I hope that if the HDA really is facilitating general the lowest, then the middle income. I guess that was the highest income. Bulletin, that one cannot work. It's a palito approach. Cannot work. But I do think that we should really encourage that, because I think the agents should be able to cover, I think, the large number of people who are almost left out precisely because of they don't fall within the subsidized one by the RTP type of development, but at the same time they don't have enough money, they don't earn enough money to have mortgages or bonds. I think to me, really, the agency, if you could play a critical role to close this gap, because as they're imaging large number of people, highly learned young individuals who have really disposable income now between 9 and 15 and 20. 9 and 15 really general. I think this agency, if you can assist us in general development, really, not to forget that there are these elements. It's a very mobile, young, very vibrant team in general who are moving in between of this. They're not earning a lot of money, but at the same time, they're not earning less money. They're in between 9 and 15. I think we should try to come. If the agency does that, and then government at the local level, I guess they can do the subsidy one in general. I think the easiest thing. I think the large number of people now that come, we will argue question of rural areas, whether the communal development will ever assist anyone. Anyway, I always take a view that people will always migrate to urban areas, whether they like it or not. Therefore, our planning should be about accommodating people who migrate anyway in Ngomezulu to urban areas. Even if you can go to Kala and build a nice house for this young poor man, surely really would never remain in Kala without job opportunity. This will be a migrant person. Is there something that I think the area that we should also be focusing on at the policy level? How to ensure that we support the agents when they are engaging in some of the intergovernmental relations, but as overseers, really, as the portfolio committees? Because in all levels of government, there are portfolio committees anyway, even at the council level. And I guess that we do have counterparts in all spheres of governance that we should engage politically to address some of the issues that would assist them on that. I think that's a point that really I wanted to make, not a real question, but if we can work on that way, this could really assist us a lot to address, of course, the tough from Alexander, as you know. In fact, the large number of people, you know that there's a development in the FIS Bank and the RGP general, but the large number that is complaining in Alexander, are those really who can't be covered by RTP also can't get bonds? It's a very growing number. It is causing more problems for us now in Ireland than ever before, because they're very vibrant and also very articulate team. Young people who are educated are very articulate. Therefore, I think if we can cover that point by these agents and do that, I think it seems there's hope, and I think the agents and it's doing well. It's very young, of course. And I think it's going to experience a lot of challenges on this matter. But I think at the policy level, those are issues that I wanted to raise.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I've also been partly covered, but my concern initially was that this young department seems to have spent a lot of time trying to establish itself, which is quite commendable. They seem to be having their organogram quite well structured. Now, I also allude to the fact that some of the things I was going to ask have been addressed, like the lower middle class. Lower middle income class people, what is going to be done about them, are there any arrangements in the rural areas, because that is also our concern, that even if they are migrating to the cities, even the people who are allegedly high income earners, they do have their homes in the rural areas, and they would like to have them attended to or put up. Now, with all what we have seen through oversight, is there any agency that has been embarked on by HDA to fast track the problems that have been encountered by the existing what is existing in the settlements area all over the world, I mean all over the country, because there seems to be a lot of uprisings all over the place, and we seem to be the people who are pointed fingers at, and is there any agency attached to their operation? Thank you.
Thank you. Another quick one.
Thank you, Chairperson. I wish I was the chairperson, then I can go let Madam Bowman speak last. Anyway, mine is very simple. Firstly, I just want to thank you for the presentation, and it was really very fruitful. My other question is, firstly, where is the HDA offices in Cape Town? I need the address. And the other question that I have, I see there is about 2,000 hectares of land that is awaiting. And where is this land? Which province? If you can stipulate that. And the other thing is, how far is HDA with the N2 gateway? Because I would like to know, there is a big mess there. And there's lots of things that we can talk about, maybe out of the meeting. Then the last question is, since the N2 gateway is very vast, how far are we with the Boys Town in Old Crossroads about the development there? Because those shacks have been there since 1985, and it's also part of the N2 gateway. I think I'll end there, Chairman. Thank you.
Honorable Mama. Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. It would seem as if, even though the members complained that they may not be able to ask questions, I think the HDA is indeed flooded with questions. Remember at the beginning we said because we didn't have the document, we have proof and ask the question, but it doesn't look like we have proof. Anyway, my point has been raised actually on the question of a state organ buying from another state organ. I think my colleague there has already put it quite well, so I'll be interested in the answer. But otherwise, I just want to find out if you coordinate with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, how do you relate to that department in terms of your work and your function? Because it seems to me there is some overlap. There may be overlap in the functioning of your agency and also in the budgeting itself. Do you find that there are any constraints, or do you find that there are any duplications in the kind of work that you are doing, particularly with the acquisition of land and the use of the land itself, but also with the planning of the settlements themselves? Because I think that the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform is also very concerned with how people get settled in the rural areas. Now, how does your agency fit in there? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Bula.
Thank you, Chair. I think that we have covered most of the important aspects. But, you know, Chair, it is always important to cut your suit according to your cloth. From the presentation that we have here in front of us, the HDA has an enormous task. And my concern is around the issue of the working capital. Whilst you may have very, very good plans of action to implement, could you elaborate some of your obstacles in delivering on the plans that you visualize? You say money talks the language. The other area of concern would be the organigram. You did indicate that we are glad that you have people of competence. But do you have any positions that are not filled in the organigram? Because you did allude that there has been some positions that have not been filled, which might have an impact on delivering on some of your mandates. I'd like to know the office in KZN, the address. The challenges that you have with the KZN province at the moment, I don't want to get into detail with that one. I think we'll take a discussion with you later. But what is the progress and what are your challenges in terms of the Tigrinya municipality, the provincial, and you as an entity? Is that all finalized? I'm very much concerned about the intergovernmental relations agreement. Is all concluded? Has it been finalized? It's pointless, Chairperson, to say that we want to move forward and have certain things materialized whilst you have certain agreements which have not been finalized. By when? What is the time frame? Because I would assume this will give you mandate and direction to deliver on the other aspects. Yeah, Chair, I'll leave it there for now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Zuma. I think one aspect I would like to raise with the HDA is the question of regulation, because to my belief, the regulations have to be brought before the portfolio committee. So what is the progress on that? Because we won't allow the situation where we are going to bring regulations when they are finalized, when they have been approved by the minister. We won't accept that because we are not the rubber stamp. The reason why we put an emphasis that the regulation should be brought before, the portfolio committee have to make an input, because the devil is in the application, in the implementation of the legislation. You'll find that the committee fights to make sure that the bill is passed, and it has got everything in place. But when it comes to implementation, you find that there are problems because the regulations have been manipulated. So we won't accept that. The second point is about, I want to check the HDA, the involvement in the projects that were run by Tubelisha, because we were informed that all those projects are going to be taken over by HDA. Because, Mr. Mgomezu, I want you to take this message to Mr. Dlabantu to say, we are tired as the portfolio committee to find ourselves as being the call center of the department. Because what is going on? People are complaining every day. I've got a pile of letters in my office. I just passed them to Mr. Dlabantu's office. Because people are complaining of the Tubelisha project, more especially in Eastern Cape. There are contractors that have contacted us. Some are phoning colleagues even at night, the committee secretary. I don't know what the committee secretary is going to do about that. They are complaining. So they are complaining that they have not been paid by Tubelisha. So there's quite a lot, but we'll find those documents in the office of Mr. Dlabantu. We want those things to be resolved. Yes, we cannot blame our people, because if that our people don't receive any response from the department or from the provinces, they will come to us as Parliament, and we have to make sure that those things are resolved. The president, the call center, is overloaded with human settlement problems. Now, Common Committee is also overloaded. What is the call center doing? The other point I wanted to look at is the issue of acquiring land versus the properties, because there are properties that I think you have to acquire, and we haven't heard anything about the properties that we have been acquiring. Why I'm raising this, we have to run away from buying properties where we are going to perpetrate rental, and we'll find that there's quite a lot of immigrants that are renting those houses, and then you find that our people are not being accommodated. So we have to get to hear what is going on about those properties, because in terms of the Social Housing Act, yes, we do have an act in place, but that Social Housing Act also accommodates the cooperatives. Though I think the Portfolio Committee has to look at this making sure that we initiate a legislation on the cooperatives, because this government is promoting the communities to be more accommodated. And then the last point, now let me stop there for now, but with the planning part, I think it has to go to Mr. Ngumezi, because the planning of human settlement, it goes to the department itself, because I think HDA, at least they just acquire land, but the planning, it has to rest upon the department. We are going to dwell much when they come here tomorrow or Friday. Thanks. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to give an introduction and then ask some of my team members to respond. I'd like to do that for a couple of reasons. First is to have brought them all down to Cape Town and not address you would, I think, be fruitless expenditure. The second is to let you judge for yourselves as to the competency of the senior management team. The third is to allow you to see that there is, in fact, a team and to identify them so that you get to understand that we are creating a corporate culture which is cooperative and competent. So for those reasons, if you allow me, I'll ask various members to address you, Chair. Just to say a couple of things at a more general level. Urgency is obviously an important element. We need to temper that with deliberateness so that we don't commit mistakes while we do that, and that is something that we're doing. We're finding that interacting with various departments across the range that we have to, our agency is often not matched by theirs, and so we it's in the cooperative interaction that sometimes the delays occur. But nevertheless, there certainly is a view within the board, which is an excellent board, let me say. We really must compliment those who appointed them for their choice. My colleague will talk about the board in a minute. But we are moving with deliberate speed, and we are concerned much more with content rather than process, and that's sometimes an argument we get into, because people are saying, well, get the agreements in place, go through the right processes, but as I think Member Ndakani indicated, one's interested in what's behind it, because sometimes, and Member Bowman, that you can with the technology create beautiful pictures. So we're interested in that. And at the policy level, we would be very pleased to get an invitation from you to present a policy proposal around how we deal with this policy question of the acquisition of land via from other government departments. It's a complex issue. It covers a whole range of departments. It has to deal with state-owned enterprises as well as state organs. a range of complications there, but nevertheless, it's a nut we have to crack. Having said that, Chair, I wonder if I could ask Neville Chaney to deal with the issues of intergovernmental relations and also the Canubia issues. Neville, because you're closer to it. And you've also got 3 minutes, so I'm following the Chair's lead.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, just in relation to the Canubia project, the first phase of that project, as indicated, yet is 5,000 units. What we need to be aware of is that we're working within the framework of what the province and the city have agreed, so their special development plan and how they've envisaged it. I think what we need to be able to be very careful is that the agency we provide the support, so we're not there to dictate what metros or cities or provinces should do. We actively, so we work within the framework we find correct and try and ensure that, for example, in that 5,000 units, there is an integrated plan that allows for fully subsidized, a sort of contouring, fully subsidized and affordable. And that's how I understand that and the business plan has been approved both by the Itekwini Metro and it is now with the province. The tender for that first 5,000 services has been prepared. It's just awaiting the finalization of the funding between the province and Itekwini. And there has been challenges in relation to that, because as members will be aware, there has been a challenge on the funding. So that's how it pans out there. We're part of the committee that sits and assists with them. So I think in many respects what has happened in the Itekwini Canubia case is that we've been able to achieve with our assistance and our strategic support within the last 9 months. We've gone from a situation where the land was acquired to where the business plan was approved and to where a project manager's been appointed pending the finalization as well as the services. So I think we're not taking overall responsibility, but we've been able to ensure, and I think what it demonstrates is that if we all work together in a coordinated fashion without any egos, what we can achieve. And I think Canubia, with all our support and your support specifically on some of the funding issues, we can achieve that. There has been challenges. Yeah. The business plan, Chair, is an integrated settlement. So the 25,000 units that the CEO spoke about, that's just fully subsidized. It is envisaged that the entire project, in terms of the human settlement, will consist of 55,000, covered from fully subsidized right up to high end. It includes retail, it includes commercial, it includes industrial. Part of the affordable will be in relation to what will be managed by Tongat. What we need to understand is that figure, what I spoke about, I know there was an original figure about, I think it's 75. That depends on the densities. One of the problems you have with densities is that we must be very careful that we ask for higher densities, but there are downstream socio-economic consequences of high densities. And we must be very careful that we don't densify to the extent that we create and have to deal with some of the socioeconomic problems that some of these high densities. And I think the world and countrywide, we know some of the experiences where you over-densify and you have to actually de-densify. So that, you know, what we said is that will be determined by the province and the city. In relation, I just want to touch on the one issue that's been raised around the question of the metropolitan target. I think what we must be very careful is that as South Africa, we set at the turn of the century, we spoke about 2014, the millennium target of making a difference. Now, what we need to be very careful, and I think both administratively and politically, is that you can't say today, which is 2010, we're going to eradicate the backlog that we have today by 2014. Because we spoke about, and I think what you must remember is that we spoke about it as South Africa
as long ago as 2002, 2004. So we need to measure ourselves as at the time government made the commitment, which was in 2003, 2004. What was the target then? And we're moving across. Because when we get to 2014, we are still going to have an issue of upgrading and formalization. It's a consequence of urbanization. So I think we must be very, very sort of mature about it as a country, about not placing too much of emphasis on the 2014, because in South Africa, the reality is we've made huge strides in the Millennium Development Goal of 100 million, of making a difference to 100 million families worldwide. Just on in relation to the issues of the intergovernmental relations, as with any intergovernmental, as with any agreement, as with any nature, you will have those tensions, but those are healthy tensions. So the agreements in the KZN province and Itequini, we've moved along. There are issues around the question of monies and accreditation and those kind of things. But I think, as I've indicated, what we need to be very careful is that we're dealing within an intergovernmental relations framework. We've got a constitutional framework, and we've each got to be able to respect our roles and responsibilities around that. What we need to also be as part of that, of those agreements, and what we've undertaken is that we've consulted, and we've consulted up to date as we sit now with 7 provinces, where we're looking at agreements or implementation protocols for land acquisition, so which will allow us as the HDA to undertake land acquisition for the provinces. We're working together with the department and the provinces to allow for those agreements to be concluded and the monies to flow. What that allows is that you have the real object of the agency being accountable and responsible for land acquisition. So from an accountability, from a parliamentary and a political accountability, you can then hold the HDA accountable for any land acquisition for human settlement. And I think it's a neat, good arrangement. Chair, the last point is, in relation to the regulations, you're correct, Chair, we've, together with the department, we've indicated that we will, during the course of April, we've targeted to present the draft of the regulations before this committee, before we present it to anyone. So that what we will do is that, based on what the committee debates, agrees, we will then take that out for consultation. So I mean, we would welcome your comment on the process, because, you know, I always say that we present it to you so that you agree on what we can go and consult outside with before. So when we present the regulations to the minister, there's been a collective, inclusive process that allows for a situation where there's harmonization between parliament, minister, the provinces, and the municipalities. So I hope that Chair, we take guidance from you whether or not whether the process that we're suggesting is the correct one. But the department obviously will be part of that process.
If we can just follow the kind of the workflow process, if you like, we kind of get the agreements, then we get the land, then we do the project. So if I can ask Mr. Leshabani from the land point of view to respond.
May I just make one follow-up?
Okay.
Because I think I don't have experience in international about this issue, but I guess the point that you are raising, that over the intensification can also cause social problems. Because I think we move from the premise that you save a lot of resources if you intensify it in such a way that it's easy for transport and other things to be viable. I'm not sure whether there is any example in South Africa that you think can be cited as an area where densification has already caused social problems. down the line. I would thought of you before I think it's identified in such a way that I don't think there's any important problem. But I think we can cite one example that could assist me just to make sense of the point that you are raising. And then that's because I think generally a view is created that now the interpretation could assist us to address the question of life, particularly in our future. Because most of the time I think in Durban, generally that land that is 2010, I think is far away from the city. I'm not sure how many kilometers, 2 kilometers sometimes. But far away from the city because the land, the inner city land generally is no longer available for whatever reason. But I thought you were arguing the point that you must have the space within the principle of the city that you can pass in such a way that it maximizes the provision of basic services and transport. Even in fact, if you argue for the BRT, that is the BRT, whatever BRT, I'm not sure what you call them in Japan, but I know that the BRT is some type of a thing, that you only survive if there's enough customers or clients everywhere. Therefore, identification is very important for that question. And I think you argued another point on this matter. That's the point I've that I'm just making for us to clarify my mind. Because I'm one of those that believe that you must intensify our teaching. I think there's a lot of space that is wasted in our cities, whatever reason. I think you are questioning us. The issue that about down the line, 20 years down the line, we have to create slab. Unfortunately, there's a lot of slab created by this intensification. The point that I wanted just to raise.
Yeah, Chairman, if you take, for example, some of the experiences you've had on the Cape Flats, if you take some of the experiences that you've had in some of the sort of former Indian and coloured areas in some of the parts of Durban, for example, Chatsworth, you'll find. And I think the point that we're making is that when you densify, we need to be conscious of the input, the developmental input and the human resources, especially when you're dealing with lower income families, the social networks, the kind of support for maintenance, those kind of things. I think that the point is that densification is supported, but it's to ensure that it works, is we must be mindful of the fact that it must be done in a sort of managed proper way. And I think we're on the same page here with Member Dakar. But I think, you know, there's a couple of examples where we can learn from that. I hope that
Even internationally. Can bring that, can assist us by bringing those examples.
Yeah, we can do that, sure. Thank you.
Madam Chair and honorable members, I think what I will do, I will just address myself to these areas that relate to land and properties. I think the important point of departure is really that the HDA Act provides for the agency to acquire land, whether it's private or publicly owned or communal land. Our program is aimed at satisfying all those. Now, in respect of, and I will begin to then say, when we raise the funding constraint question, it is not so much that we are asking for an endless supply of money, but even if we acquire state land, which we believe, discussions are now that we will acquire state land and it will come into us for free. However, state land does not exist in isolation. You may have to then assemble that together with privately owned land to create the development that is sustainable, is integrated. There lies the poison. That if we are unable to acquire privately owned land to unlock state land, you are not resolving the problem. So it is that perspective that we are seeking to resolve. And we are comfortable, Madam Chair, that together with the Department and Treasury, we will open discussions in the next few months so that the MTF process takes that into account. So the arrangement is that we will then put on the table a funding model, an operating model that begins to answer those questions, and then decisions will then be made going forward. In respect of the 2,000 hectares that we're talking about, just about half are in the Western Cape. There are agreements in place around that land being made available to the agency, and that is the land we're talking about partly. The balance, which is, again, about 1,000 hectares, is the properties that Servcon had acquired from Transnet at the behest or at the request of the department at the time when we were busy establishing the agency. Now, we are busy with Servcon and the department attending to the transfer of those properties to the HDA. Those properties, they are across several provinces, and we believe that we will make good use of those. However, Chair, that must be seen in the context that going forward, the agency is engaging with Transnet to say, let's look at your portfolio and other state-owned enterprises so that we can then begin to isolate the properties, land, and properties, because sometimes it's both, which are suitable for viable settlement development. And therefore, that is our work going forward. It's not just isolated or restricted to these two. This is just the beginning. The President spoke about 6,000 hectares of state land, specifically for low-income households as well as the middle or affordable income household housing development. So that will then enable the attention to be paid towards the gap market, as members have indicated. And lastly, Chair, we enjoy incredibly, possibly unprecedented support from the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. The agreement that is being negotiated seeks exactly to delineate what will then be the part of the agency in respect of rural development and what will be the part of other role players. So we are very comfortable that we are in this discourse. We will then be able to agree. The agency will attend to specified areas alongside other role players in that regard. Madam Chair, the last area that was pointed out relates to, in our land acquisition, do we also acquire properties? I can confirm, Madam Chair. Our land acquisition, what we refer to as land acquisition, is really the acquisition of land and what you call landed properties. And in that, we are seeking, working with the department, to be able to make available properties, and depending on what they are, in some cases, these are inner city structures, multi-story. Therefore, that creates the opportunity for the provinces, the municipalities, and the department to be able to attend to the rental question. And then there are policies available in that regard to regulate what happens. Madam Chair, I will pause there. There was a question, Madam Chair, around, is this still the arrangement that funding still goes to the provinces when in fact it's earmarked for certain things? There are two parts to that. The one is that the housing grant, as it stands, it allows for provinces to be able to provide for land acquisition, which then they will then undertake. That's been the practice all along. The discussions that are underway right now is to allow for the department to review that so that a portion of the grant is then specifically ring-fenced for land acquisition through the agency. At the moment, that's not the case, but that's the direction where we are going. The other part, Madam Chair, relates to some of the projects, the monies of which are then also ring-fenced, but then go to the provinces, and as the provinces engage with the HDA, they are then able to release that money. Konobia is one such. It was specifically ring-fenced, but the money, because it's a conditional grant, it goes, it went to the province, and then the province has to release that money, whether for land acquisition there at the municipality or fund the municipality, as the case may be. And there are several other examples. In itself, Madam Chair, it is not a problem. The trouble with that is that who do you hold accountable? If then it's the agency that is implementing, yet it has no ability to control or even manage the funding in that context, then you have a problem. And it's very subjective. And therefore, we simply say it's better to have a better arrangement in regard of the funding that is ring-fenced and how it flows and the timing of that flow, so that we are not responsible for something that we can't account for, and vice versa. We don't want the province to be accountable for something that they have no responsibility over. So it's really that question of alignment. And I think from what I've been part of, the department is supportive of clearly defined funding arrangements going forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any additional?
Madam Chair, we've still got two more areas to cover. The one is the kind of projects, and the second is the kind of board and governance areas. Before just asking Adet to comment on the project stuff, just let me say this about our relationship vis-a-vis Tubulisha. We were mandated to take over two of the priority projects that Tubulisha was involved in, which we have done. In the sense that we took over the staff and the offices of those two in Cape Town and Port Elizabeth as of the 1st of August, and we are still in the process of finalizing the various agreements that allow us to continue from a technically legal position. Having said that, though, we have done the actual work in running those projects. There are no other arrangements in place for us to deal with the project that Tubulisha has been involved in, and Tubulisha and the department have been negotiating with the provinces. So we have no insight or comment on that process. And having said that, if I can just hand over to Adet.
Yeah, I think that one, the department has to take a responsibility, because if there are cases that are following Tubulisha and we have paid a large sums of money to for this closure of Tubulisha, and we still have these spooks following us, I think the department has to take a responsibility and accountability of that. Because before we had that, they should have made that there are no spooks. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. To comment on some of the project's work, maybe to start, our office in Cape Town is at 129 Bree Street, but also you will find we have a site office at Delft 79, where we're trying to get closer to the community so that they don't have to travel to the inner city to see the HDA and ask their questions. So at Delft 729, we also have an office, a site office. And on the Joe Slovo project, we also have a site office within the 709 units where people can contact us. And then we are trying in the projects going forward for the Into Gateway to have locally based offices where the community members can come and talk to us. In the interim, we are seeing the community members on a regular basis, and I'll elaborate on that in a minute. In terms of the big question on how far is the Into Gateway, there is a number of complexities on the Into Gateway which we are systematically working through, and the effects of those are going to be visible in the next few months as it becomes evident and the momentum gains in the project. To look at the statistics then, in terms of services delivered for the sites, Joe Slovo, Boystown, Newry, Delft Symphony and Delft 79, which are the main areas of focus of the HDA at this point in time. On all of the sites excluding Boystown, the services are 100% complete. In Delft 7 to 9, they are about 96-97% complete. And in New West, they are also at the 98% complete. So largely services across the entry gateway, excluding Boys Town, are complete, which means the large focus at the moment is on the top structure delivery. The project that is moving quite rapidly at the moment is Delft 7 to 9, and it should be finished within this year. Movement is not possible within Delft Symphony because of the legal arrangements and the problems with Ibuyele. Newrest is nearing completion, but I will note Newrest has complexities because it's a combination of contractor and PHP builds, and there's specific dynamic there. There is a problem with some of the servicing, which is something that has to be legally followed up with a contractor. So when you visit Newrest, unfortunately, you will find the sewers are an enormous problem, and we are aware of it. We are engaging with the city around that, but it's something we have to resolve legally. We are trying to assist with the PHP component there and get the contractor project component completed and out of the project so that it can be completed as PHP. With regards to Joe Slovo, we are working very closely with the project. There are two streams of work, community consultation, which is a big element, and then the technical design, layout, and approval of those components so that the actual infrastructure and top structure work can be done. And that project will take a form of a much higher density project than what you've seen in the rest of Entry Gateway. In terms of Boys Town, there is a contractor who submitted a tender for that component. We've re-engaged with that contractor, and he is willing to restart work. So we are concluding agreements with that contractor together with the province so that work can start on Boys Town in terms of the layout and designs, which would relate to the infrastructure work, and following that, the top structure work would relate. But quite importantly in Boys Town, a community development process has also been initiated because there's the main Boys Town community, there's some fire victims, there's the Philippi and so on, and all of them need to be brought together to finalize that project. But both of those work streams are underway. Technically, the work will be restarting, I would say, in the next month, given that contracts are being concluded with the province, with that contractor, to re-emerge on the work there. Overall, in terms of top structure completion, we are halfway with the top structures, and we're looking at the balance of the top structures being constructed over a 2 to 2.5 year period to complete the projects that I mentioned. Obviously, Boys Town and Joe Slovo, the infrastructure and top structure work has to be done, so that cannot be done in 1 year. It takes about 2 years to get that complete. I should emphasize that we've introduced an overall new community engagement and development framework. We've got individual precinct plans for every single precinct, which details exactly what's going to happen, how it's going to happen. But what has been constraining us a little bit, but hopefully should reach conclusion, is that the legal handover hasn't been concluded. And there have been various challenges to that. Province has been spearheading that and is quite supportive on that in terms of closing off contracts with Tbilisi, signing contracts with the contractors, and then signing with us as well. And because of the complexities, that has taken quite long. What I do want to emphasize, and that is working very well in the N2 Gateway, the cooperation between the city, the province, and ourselves around the project, as well as national, is working very well. The City of Cape Town is coming, and we're working through all of the issues and concerns that they've had on the project so that they re-engage completely and are supporting the project. Chair, I haven't mentioned the TRAs, but on the TRAs, there are a number of TRAs that the province is responsible for with us managing it relating to the N2 Gateway. We've recently met with the City of Cape Town to go through so that the maintenance, the upkeep, the cleaning, all of those elements of the TRAs also get addressed. So we've started working through those issues, and there are various complexities there about who owns the land, who's contractually responsible, and what can actually be done. Apart from clearing those technical issues, we also are engaging with those communities. We've got an overall movement plan approved for the project so that it's very clear who is moving where and when. Our challenge is we've got more beneficiaries than sites to move them to. So we have to work out that element and be clear with the communities about that element so that they don't wonder where am I going and what's going to happen with me, but that it's very clear. and the governance structures are assisting so that those approvals are obtained and managed in the correct manner, and that we don't send conflicting messages. Our challenge is that we've been quiet because the legal arrangements haven't been sorted, and we don't want to speak outside of our contractual and legal mandate on the project. So at the moment, the province and the city are speaking and leading on the project until we have our legal arrangements sorted. But Boystown, it will start moving. You will start seeing development in the next month as we conclude the contracts and the community project starts. Chair, in the Eastern Cape, Zanambula, there's two parts to Zanambula. There's the existing projects, and then there's a series of four or five new projects relating to Zanambula. On the new projects, by the end of this month, all of the tenders for the new work will be out. And as HDA, we are ready to initiate on the new projects. On the existing projects, it's come to a complete standstill because of the delays in the legal handover, and that's between National Tbilisi and Province to sort that out. And it's on the existing projects in Zanambula plus other Tbilisi projects where the contractors have been quite frustrated and are now at the point where there is no work happening because of non-payment. It's out of the HDA's control to assist that. Our team has tried as far as possible on the ground to do what is required, but because we do not have legal standing, it's something that we cannot sort out and resolve, and we have alerted National, Province and Tbilisi to this. And it is obviously a concern that the existing work has stopped because there's a lot of pressure from the community and the municipality to get the work going. We seem to get it going, but it's out of our hands. On the new stuff, we're working at speed and pending us signing with the province so that we can execute fully on our mandate and sign contracts to get the work done. We are ready to move on the new pieces of work.
Okay. Thank you. There's no other. Okay.
Okay, we've got one more contribution.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to speak on the governance issues. I think it's mostly governance, and there's one question on HR. To answer the question of how many board members we have seven, of which four are completely independent. Three are appointed by the they're representatives from three of the departments that we depend upon, like rural development and land. And then two that are executives, which is the CEO and the CFO. As far as remuneration of top structure is concerned, if you're talking about the executive level, the bands are well within the required bands. They have been researched and they're within the bands of the sector. To be specific, the band falls between 1 million to 2 million rand, and they are in line with the government structures as well. As far as the organogram is concerned and vacancies that might impact on service delivery, at this point in time, there are 15 vacancies in the HDA, of which 6 positions are filled as at, I think it's actually 5 as at 1 March, and 1 vacancy is being postponed and will be filled on 1 April. The other vacancies will be filled throughout the year, so that will leave us with 9 vacancies to fill between now and year end. I think that's all the questions on governance. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Is there any follow-up or any other interaction from the members? Another Ukula, you are the only one. And then we'll give Mr. Ngomezu.
Thank you, Chief. Very, very briefly, I just wanted to get the information on your offices in KZN. And secondly, I'm very pleased to hear that the land acquisition and the alignment in order to achieve the synchronization is very, very important. And nevertheless, there are still challenges in Itegweni. I'd like to take the discussion after.
Thank you, Chair. We don't have an office in KZN. We only have offices in Johannesburg, Cape Town and Port Elizabeth. As and when the need arises, we obviously will look at offices elsewhere, but we don't have, those are the three offices we have at this point in time. And we would welcome, I think there were two suggestions of interaction, or three suggestions of interaction going forward, Madam Chair. We would perhaps a little later, when we are able to say to you, okay, all these agreements are in place, this is the land we've got, so perhaps towards the end of this year, we would welcome hosting you on a visit to the various projects. And secondly, on the specific areas where you have a particular interest, we would be always open to discussion about particular areas of problems and plans going forward.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to touch up on the issue of Tubelisha. Let me just indicate that closing a state entity or a public entity is a very messy affair. It's not an easy affair. Tubelisha has ceased operations in July last year, so it's not operating. Currently, the process which is unfolding is to seek back some of the projects back to the provinces. Now, this has been achieved in most provinces, KZN, Gauteng, Limpopo. The only outstanding provinces would be Western Cape, especially the N2, and also Zanimvula. Now, sitting back these, there were two alternatives. Tubelisha could have ceded these projects back to the province without doing a recon, so that assets and liabilities would have been inherited by the province. But the provinces requested a recon to be done on each of the mega projects. Now, what has emerged is that in certain projects within the mega projects, there have been cases of overpayment, over invoicing, fraud. In each case, what Tubelisha has done, once that was discovered, a case was opened with the police, and the project handed over together with the case number to the province. So the department is mindful of the fact that there are certain disputes which are taking place between contractors and Tubelisha. We are attending to that with the assistance of our service provider and Tubelisha. So I would also report the displeasure of the chairperson with people phoning the portfolio committee.
Even the secretary.
I will register that with the department. But we are aware of some of the problems, and some of the problems is because of over-invoicing and also claiming for units which were never delivered. People were paid for units which were never delivered. We will provide this committee with a full report of each problem area. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. No, I think this meeting has been so fruitful. I think the department has noted or has registered. This noting part, I don't like it. We register the damage that you nearly do. Because if this committee was not a committee that is very much constructive, and the committee that really, really serious about it, a committee that is really committed about the assignment that they have been given by the parliament or the people of South Africa. Really, we should have just chased you away, but we felt that we cannot do that, but we have to point fingers. So I think you have registered that, and from the deliberations
coming out of this committee, I mean of this meeting, I'm sure you are appreciating and you will appreciate that if we had the information before, it was going to be more elaborative. And what is important, we are here to assist. We are here to provide support because people are looking at Parliament. But Parliament without the support from the department or the entities that we have created ourselves to play that supportive role to Parliament, we cannot make it. So we must consider this serious, that we are all important. Parliament is important. You are also important. So you must play that role of your importance significantly. So we really appreciate the information, but I think the most important part is the issue. We have to make sure that we follow up this funding challenge. We would appeal to the HTA because the portfolio committee is very much busy. The program is very hectic. But you are also allowed to just the chairperson, we are ready. When can we come and present our funding model? Whatever you want to share with the portfolio committee, you have got that right. You don't have to wait for the committee to call you. Because if you do that, the committee will may prioritize other issues. They feel that they are urgent to themselves. Yet you, on your side, you still feel that you need the portfolio committee to address you in other areas. So we would appreciate if you can also assist us. Ms. Kwazi, you know, can't get anything with them. What is that? Like, it must bong, okay, sit okay. They are bullied like a kulu, umsanga no, sit is your bala. Singoma, the department, Singoma, in members, the participation, yes. They are born, Mr. Mkumizu, you are going to have a tough time this term. Sound bong as well with my term. You are going to have a tough time. And I think what we have forgotten to put in as the apology to Mr. Dlabantu. Mr. Dlabantu apologized. He phoned me yesterday to say today they are having a main talk this morning. So I think it is important. If you have seen who Mr. Lerumo, we are also laughing because he has been called to join that meeting. So it was just a mishap on our side and with you, Mr. Mkumi. Forgot it before that. The meeting at the end. Thanks. The committee. No. Sorry. The committee. It's a colleague of mine. It's a legal services. Oh, man, you see that? I've forgotten you must see that.
Oh, it's from the department. The is a legal service from the department.
Oh, no, at the department. At the car, look on. Look at the car.
Okay.
I think we are ready. We can start. Let me welcome the legal services, the parliamentary legal services unit, and I think we have developed a fruitful or a very good relationship with this unit. But I always contact them. I'm just keeping them in their toes each and every time that whenever we do have some, I don't understand the issues, and they are always there for us. Even when we postpone the meetings, but they don't get tired to come before us. So we would like to express our appreciation from the Legal Services Unit to provide that support, because they are expected to provide support to the committee. And I would like to commend for that, because in the Portfolio Committee of Human Settlement, they are doing very well. Over to you, Atika.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. And I think yesterday at the committee, a member asked me if I was if I was assigned to that committee, and I said yes. And he said, is it your only committee? I said, no, it's one plus seven more. So I do apologize if I'm not as visible, but I do try to be available when I'm required.
and we're trying to do it on a priority basis. So if you are dealing with something that doesn't really require legal advice, then of course I will attend to other committees that do. But thank you for acknowledging, as you did, my my contribution to this committee. I have a very personal interest in property, by the way, because I come from a property background. And I was very interested. I spent about 8 years at the City Council in land management. So I was very interested in this, and if the committee would indulge me, I'd like to share one small experience, because I did an internship in San Francisco many years ago in public participation before we even knew of the of how the concept works. It was a matter, something I had an interest in. And the high density problem we actually saw there, and it was addressed in one of the, I forget what they call these areas, but anyway, it's equivalent to our Cape Flats. And where they based, I was attached to the planning and housing section in the City Council of San Francisco. But I think what saved them was, you know, their houses are movable, and they had a planning, they identified a planning fault where the houses were much like our complex, high-rise buildings where it's kind of two U's put facing each other, so you have a quad in the center. And you also have the staircase with a landing in between. And these were the areas where crime became rife, where drug abuse and that sort of thing became quite prominent. And because the way they construct the houses, you can actually, it's modular units that you could actually lift and move. I was there whilst they reconfigured an entire township, virtually, where they lifted the units and faced it outwards towards the street instead of forming that courtyard, you know. The other problem, one of the minor problems besides sewage was sharing spaces, like washing lines, who has the right to win. And I just thought I'd share that experience because I'm not so passionate about the project that I worked on. And I think the member raised that question, and I can actually see the problems with densification. Okay, that's thanks. Just an aside. Thank you for indulging me. I'm here to talk about treaties, and I think the question emanates from a process that has recently transpired where an agreement was sent to the committee, referred to the committee, and then it was withdrawn because there was a realization that it was sent under the wrong section or subsection of Section 231 of the Constitution. I was meant to be accompanied by someone from the NA who could actually tell us how that came about, but she's unavailable, so I will try. And I just quickly looked at the actual documents or agreements, and I can actually see why that happened and why it was dealt with in a particular way. But I think let's first start with trying to analyze or define what a treaty is. A treaty, according to CITES on international law, or treaties are agreements that only bind the parties to them, or the states to them, that have been agreed to be bound by their provisions. So in other words, only those states that have signed or who have signed and ratified whatever the requirements of the particular state is, only those states are bound to the treaty. Now, treaties go by many names. These are names, these are just a list of names that are used synonymously, although treaty has a very specific meaning, in modern usage it has taken on a more general meaning. So sometimes when we refer to treaties, we talk about conventions or declarations, charters, covenants, pacts, protocols, memorandum of agreement. Now all of these terms are loosely or generally used interchangeably, although historically they all have more specific meanings. but it's more the general meaning that has become common use. For example, if you look at the word convention and charter, that is more a more formal type historically, or its specific meaning is a more formal type of agreement. Whereas if you look at memorandum of agreement, you can almost hear that's the more loose, that is just a memo setting down an understanding, basically. And declaration, I declare to, you know, it has different background meanings, but I think for our purposes, we accept that they are used synonymously today. Now, international law does not describe how a state exercises treaty-making power. In other words, each country, each state has its own unique way of how they bring a treaty into being, how they accept to be bound by a treaty. In our domestic law, in the pre-constitution, it was by and large an executive power. In the interim constitution, recognizing that some of these have impact on our domestic law, it became legislative action was enhanced. But then, with the new constitution, realizing also that you don't need an overkill of legislative involvement, there is now a kind of shared power, which is what we will focus on, how that shared power now works. So it's a shared power between the legislative and executive. let us start by looking at the constitutional provision on treaty signing and ratification processes. Section 231 provides that negotiating and signing is the responsibility of the national executive. Okay, so that is the starting point. But the Republic is only bound after the National Assembly and NCLP has approved by resolution. However, treaties, and this is where the difficulty arises, treaties of a technical, administrative, or executive nature, or an agreement which does not require either ratification or accession entered into by the National Executive, binds the Republic without approval by the NA and the NCLP, but must be tabled in the Assembly and the Council within a reasonable time. And I think that is what gives rise not only to the difficulties that this committee has, but even amongst experts. Because how does one now decide or assess which agreements are of a technical, administrative, or executive nature? What does that mean? You know, in other words, when can it be binding without even any involvement of Parliament, except for it being tabled? Then subsection 4 provides that any international agreement becomes law in the Republic. Now, there's a difference here between just being binding and actually becoming law that's applicable to the public at large. So subsection 4 provides that any international agreement becomes law in the Republic when it is enacted into law by national legislation. But a self-executing provision of an agreement that has been approved by Parliament is law in the Republic unless it is inconsistent with the Constitution or an Act of Parliament. Save the questions on what now is a self-executing agreement, because now we're again looking at two types. One is, once it is signed internationally, for it to become binding on our citizens, it must be enacted into law. However, we now see another sort of caution creeping in. If it's self-executing, then it's law without us having to enact it into law. So that's another discussion which we will have in a short while. And then just lastly, 231 also provides that international agreements which were binding when the Constitution took effect remain binding. Now, from the above, there appears to be these four categories of treaties. Now, excuse me for the repetition, but I just want to be able to break it down, because I know when I said to the chairperson, it's actually quite simple the wrong thing to have said, because when I actually thought, how am I going to put this across, I realized exactly how complicated it can become. So I do repeat a little bit. So just now to look at what are the four categories from the wording of Section 231. You have a category which is in Subsection 3, which must be tabled, and that is those technical, administrative, or executive ones, only tabling. So then there are those which actually require a ratification by resolution of both houses, which is what we thought had to be done to this initially. The one that was that first came in terms of section subsection 2, and then it was withdrawn and said, no, no, it should have come as subsection 3. I'm not losing anyone, am I? Okay. Does that mean yes, I am?
He said, but I understand.
Am I too fast?
No. Okay. No, you are not too fast, but I'm trying to say you must make sure that when you get out of that door, we all understand.
I'll make sure of that. Okay. So the four categories again. One is those strange ones, which are either technical, administrative, or executive. Second one is what actually requires ratification by both houses. Okay? And those are the two we're going to focus on. How do we distinguish between these two? And then we have a category, subsection 4, those requiring enactment to become law. I think that is the easier one, because it's something where if we want it to be binding on our citizens, we must actually write it into our law. And then there's a self-executing provision also in subsection 4. I tried to break it down a little bit. Which can operate without any involvement of Parliament. Okay? In other words, it can just operate because it is self-executing. And as I promised, we will discuss what self-executing is. Now, in this process, let's just again look at the powers of the executive vis-a-vis that of the legislature. I said at the beginning, the power to make treaties is a shared power between these two. The Constitution assigns the power to negotiate and sign to the National Executive, and then they must table in Parliament if a technical, administrative, or executive. Where it does not fall into that category, it binds the Republic only after it has been approved by resolution, unless it is self-executing. That's basically summing up what I've said. For purposes of South African law, it is the nature of the treaty that determines whether it needs parliamentary approval or merely tabling. Now, that is where I want to stop for a moment. It says now, how do we know it's section 231.2 or 231.3? In other words, when does it need just to be tabled, and when does it need to be actually approved? Okay. Now, to answer that question, I think we need to look at a practical example to try and distinguish the two. A technical, or to describe perhaps what a technical or administrative. Yeah, I do it on the next page, actually. If you look on page 10, I say, in practice, it is difficult to identify, the third bullet down. It is difficult to identify when an agreement is of a technical nature. And then I go on to say, usually, it's those routine matters that does not involve policy, but merely operational or administration related, and that relates perhaps to specific departments or urgent matters or functional projects. Now, what do we mean by that? If we look at the one that was referred to this committee recently, I don't know if the committee members have read these before you. If you look at the explanatory...
Which one is that one? Because there were two.
Oh, yes. I've got the one here dealing with the India, Brazil, and...
It was in 2008, that one.
Yes.
Yeah.
deals with Angola.
Yeah, it's similar provisions, but I just, for as an example, we just look at this one. If you look at the explanatory memorandum, okay, it says India, Brazil, I'm going to read for the purpose of those. India, Brazil, and South Africa share a common vision with regard to human settlement development and are pursuing similar domestic policies. Okay? They are already pursuing similar domestic policies. Okay? Now that tells you there's already something in place. We'll get to that. They are pursuing similar domestic policies that are socially inclusive and aimed at addressing a range of social problems. In this regard, the three countries have a mutual interest and benefit in sharing information and expertise. Okay. That for me is part of the key phrase there. We're not looking at entering into any policy negotiation at this stage. We're simply looking at how can we, at almost department level, share information and expertise. As I have just used by example when I spoke about the San Francisco example. But without that, how do we get that information? How do we learn from their experiences? How do they learn from our experiences? That is sharing information and expertise. Okay, relating to housing and human settlement. The three countries have bilateral agreements in place. Okay, that is your other key. That there's already bilateral agreements in place. Okay? And in view of the shared understanding and common desire to learn from each other's experiences, as well as to cooperate on ways to overcome challenges faced by these countries, they want to explore new areas of mutual interest. So from this kind of wording, one, we can see that there is a bilateral, in other words, a treaty in place. There is an agreement in place. This is now an agreement whereby we are saying we commit to share our experience. I'll send you resources, you'll send me resources. You can come over and shadow us so you can see how our situation works and so on. So there's no policy making involved here. It's simply administrative sharing. It's at that level. And then further on in the agreement, it also defines the period for this agreement. So one, it is based on existing agreement, international agreement that's in place. And two, it's for a duration of 2 years where we commit to share information with each other, to share our resources with each other, and then it is agreeable. So clearly this is something not of a policy nature, not that's going to impact on our country, but that is purely for administrative, that is the simplest way I can think of demonstrating this. It's simply for perhaps research sharing, experience sharing, and to learn from each other. So I think what the NA has told me, and I'm sorry that they have not been able to join us, but what they mentioned was, it was a typo when they initially said that this is one agreement that had to come in terms of section 231, what is it, 2 and not 3, or vice versa. 2, yeah. And so therefore it was simply a correction. Okay. Now, the one thing that I said we would still get to, I hope I've kind of demonstrated what the difference is now between the two. The one thing I have still not addressed is what is self-executing, self-executing provisions are. Sometimes you have in agreements or treaties, provisions that have sufficient detail for a court to understand from that agreement that is already binding on us what we intended to be bound by. In other words, there is one that deals with, let me just get this out quickly.
there is an agreement that deals with the children's rights based on the African Convention of the Rights and Welfare of the Child, which was ratified in 2000. Okay. Now, although some of these provisions have not been incorporated into our law specifically, it goes without saying that we have agreed to be bound by these provisions. So the court, in other words, let me read this paragraph to you. The African Convention of the Rights and Welfare of the Child was ratified by South Africa on 7 January 2000. It too has a number of provisions indirectly supporting social security rights for children, such as prevention of child abuse and neglect, protection of the family. If you look at the protection of the family unit, that is a concept that, in fact, in the Goedboom case, the court relied on, because our constitution also gives the court the power to look at international law. So, for example, you don't need to write up a law on detailing what that means, because that in itself is sufficient information for the court to rely on that in incorporating international law. That is basically then what has an example that I could find on a self-executing provision. So that is the difference, Madam Chair, before the, without going into too much detail on self-executing provisions between 231.2 and 231.3, which you asked me to address. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, but I think before the members interact, I think there's a missing link even from the department, from the side of the department, because they just generalize. With these agreements, they just say Section 231 of the Constitution. They don't become specific of the subsection. I'm sure that is going to cause a problem, because just subsection 231, but no clauses are being stipulated, or subsection 2, or subsection 3, or subsection 4, because the clause 231 is too broad. So we need to ensure that at least when these things are happening, we make sure that they are clearly articulated. And then I just want to check in terms of resources, sharing of resources, because you know we have a scarcity of resources. Do we share resources by when we are providing our own? I mean, we provide resources to our own technical support, and then the other country provides resources to their own technical. What is the position? I wanted to check that. Then I'm giving the members to interact. Over to you. No, let's wait for the members to get another question. Any questions from the members?
That was my question.
Oh, that was your question. I'm sorry. For a change. Okay, can you come up with a response?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Section 231 has five subsections, and that is what I break down on page 5 and page 6. I thought for ease of reading, I paraphrase those subsections. But if it's not clear, I can attempt it again. But in response to your second question, in the context, I didn't want to read out the whole agreement, I actually assumed that it had been seen. In the content, it's very specific, exchange of scientific and technical information.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not your human resources. It's simply information sharing,
mm-hmm.
and capacity building and skills transfer,
mm-hmm.
and that think department with this agreement in place has the prerogative of negotiating.
Yes.
Okay, I have someone over here for 2 weeks and then you can send someone for 2 weeks.
Yes.
That kind of arrangement. Mm. But it's more information sharing.
Are you through? Okay. Can I ask?
And you want section 231?
Yes, we can continue if you still have something to say.
No, that is all from me for now.
Is from the department?
I think you're not going to say. I think it is also important for a department also, you know, to add, you know, on one of our colleagues, actually, Farina alluded to. I think when we originally, you know, tabled, you know, this agreement, we as a department were very clear and specific with regard to the subsection within which we intended to table. We have indicated in our original submission to say that we will table them as section 2313 for specific reasons, Honorable Chair, like some of the reasons already given by my colleagues. One of the other aspects in terms of our research from our department as legal services, it was very clear to us to say that what we refer actually, you know, to the term technical administrative and executive agreement is simply referred, you know, to three categories. The one is the agreements which are departmentally specific. Talks about the day-to-day operation of the department. Secondly, are agreements which are not of major political or any other significance, which are very simple and clear, as already, you know, my colleague has alluded to. And lastly, which are the agreements which have no financial consequences or any agreements which does not actually, you know, affect even domestic law. Those are simple, you know, agreements which follow from the day-to-day activities of a department and are often drafted in a simple, you know, format like this. So I think those are the reasons, actually, you know, that, of course, influenced in our decision originally when we table them as, you know, as section, you know, 2313. So specifically for those particular kind of reasons. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Any other additions? But I still have a problem. I don't want to prepare this if I understand. Because we need to make sure that we understand this properly. Section 2 says the international agreement binds the Republic only after it has been approved by a resolution in both the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, unless it is an agreement referred to in subsection 2. We all agree on that one. But that approval by the National Assembly, what does it mean? What processes we need to follow? Because the legislation comes to, I mean, this the agreement comes to the parliamentary processes that are outside the operation of the committee. And at the same time, the committee, in terms of the parliament, has got the oversight over the activities of the department, including these MOUs, and even the parliamentary regulations. They stress that. So I don't understand now. I just want to get the clarity on that issue. Because when you are performing our oversight, you must know what you are doing.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it is for that reason that any agreement that a department binds itself to, such as this one, is tabled so that the committee can be aware that there is this agreement in place.
Mm-hmm.
And this agreement is binding on the two states or the three states who have entered into this agreement.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see, there is nothing in the agreement that would that binds the state in respect of policy,
mm-hmm,
or politically.
Okay.
It is at a very, very administrative level, okay, and technical level. That is why these words are used. So, you know, in doing your oversight, you would be guided by the fact that this agreement is in place, and therefore the department is well within its mandate to
have an exchange program for argument's sake. Now, as opposed to another agreement whereby that requires a ratification, whereby perhaps we are saying to another state or to many other states that we agree that all children at the age of 18 will be given cars on their 18th birthday. That has financial implications for the state, that has policy implications and a whole host of other things. Now, surely a minister who at the drop of a hat signed an agreement like that cannot bind the state to that extent. Okay? So that agreement will now come to Parliament and will have no binding effect unless it goes through our legislative process.
Okay.
That is where the shared power comes in. So when it comes to Parliament, it goes through the normal channels that legislation goes through, where it goes to the National Assembly, it goes to the NA, and it must be ratified as if we are dealing with legislation before it can bind the state. But in the meantime, we are, unless we communicate to that other state or other country, hold on, we really don't want to be bound. If we do nothing about it, then we are bound by it until we either ratify or we communicate our intention so not to be bound. So that is just an extreme example that I think to show.
Yes. Okay. No, I think. Another people.
No, thank you, Chair. I think you have raised a very important point. And yesterday we had a debate in the House as well, and we had the fiscal framework. And you would find that provisions have been made for committees now to hold the executive accountable. So in view of that, and in terms of the fiscal law that we are referring to in subsection 2, can a country that pursues domestic policies, as you have given us examples, agree in principle while it's not being signed? Basically, we might agree on issues, on principles, whilst our country is not annexed in law. Is there such a term?
Yes, thank you for that question. That's what I was trying to explain in my previous example, that you have to act in line with that intention, even though it is not yet law, because you've expressed an intention for it to become law. So if you no longer intend for that to become law, you must communicate your intention for it not to become law. But it is only legally binding once it is ratified. And just another point that your question made me think of was, in self-executing provisions, such as the one that I gave an example of, that will only be recognized by our courts and interpreted by our courts as in being incorporated in our law if it does not conflict with our written law or with the Constitution.
Just a follow-up. You might be placed in a predicament where it might not be law, but it's binding on the Supreme Law of the Constitution. Let's assume that we don't bind ourselves to the law and we don't have any agreements in place. If that is the situation, can the Constitution supersede that?
Our Constitution trumps.
Okay.
Full stop.
Okay. Why are
you
so sad?
No, it's supposed to be. You know, Chair, we have all these agreements signed, the bilaterals that we have signed. And if we look at the bilaterals that we have signed, we want to learn from practices and policies of other countries, etc. But you have to be placed in a knowledgeable situation to understand that you can interrogate these kind of situations that are there, and that our country is exchanging this kind of information that would add emphasis to what we want to debate in our processes. That is what I was trying to achieve.
The rectification process. You said it has to be in line with the processes that we undertake when we are passing our legislation. So you mean who ratifies those tunnels or the I mean, now there are these agreements that are before the committee. They are going to be tabled next week or next time. So what is the role of the committee on that? Is to rectify that we have received the memorandum, the MOUs, they've been tabled before the portfolio committee, and then we endorse. What is, I'm interested in the role. I have not yet satisfied myself in terms of this committee, because people just bring these documents to us and then they mean nothing. Why should you bother bringing them to us? Just keep them there. So I want to check this ratification process. That is the role of the parliament. Because it's not clear in the rules. It's just a line, and the constitution is just a line.
Yes,
Madam Chair. And we're interested in our role as the portfolio committee.
Yes.
Oversight.
Yes.
What oversight are we playing?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Unfortunately, that is part that your NA procedural people were meant to address here. So I'm left in a bit of an awkward situation not being involved in the NA and in your processes. The ratification process is really not required in these instances, as I have pointed out. These two are only for notice, so that when you do your oversight, you are cognizant of this. So it's merely for information.
We understand.
Yes.
I don't have a problem.
Right.
But we have to understand
if
all
there
the
is what?
Because the Constitution gives us a mandate.
Yes.
To play an oversight.
Yes.
What oversight are we supposed to be playing? That's the issue. In terms of the agreement. So you have answered that to say the people are supposed to come and answer that question. They're not here. So I think you have to request them. To request their indulgence to come and provide this assistance. Yes, exactly, because really, we cannot sit here as a portfolio committee. We are given a mandate. We must understand our mandate. Otherwise, we don't have a problem with this because we have already received a proper guidance. But there's something that we need more. We need more. So that when we apply our oversight, we must be sure of what we are doing. Then, Mamun Jordan, when you find yourself,
I think I can understand your concern, and I must say I admire you for that, because many SPCs, many a protocol, many of whatever you call these things have been signed by departments. Without ease consulting the portfolio committee. I remember we used to complain that we are expected position to endorse, I don't know if I'm using the correct term, to endorse a treaty that has already been discussed and signed between two parties, one department and another, as you as a committee must have endorsed. And usually they are so complicated, so involved, that there isn't even time to look into them. And by the time they come to you as a committee, everything has been settled. All you are expected to do is to appear in that podium and to me, it feels as if it's the way it works. Not just for South Africa, but I think all over internationally it works like that. I don't know how much we will succeed. I'm not trying to discourage us, but I'm just saying it's been going on for so long. And I suppose what you can what you can probably trust is that the department will not sign a treaty or endorse a treaty that can put the country into some kind of a problem. So we endorse. That's what has been happening all over the years. All the 15 years that one has been here. And as I say, usually by the time they come to you, everything has been done. The whole complicated document is there, and as a committee, you are expected to endorse it. I don't know if we can change that.
I don't agree with you. We are not endorsing. I think ever since I came to this parliament, I've been told that oversight is not just to rubber stamp. So we want to know our role here. What we are requesting, we want to know our role. Because if we don't have a role, it must be clear. So I don't think we can just simply say we are not going to succeed. I won't agree with you, Mama, with that. Because we are not here to rubber stamp. We do have rules. So our rules must be clearly defined. We should know our rules. And I think it is the responsibility of this portfolio committee to make sure that we understand. People must come before us and explain. Because if things were done in that way, if those things can be changed, if there's a need, if they don't shoot, they are not suitable. If we were representing 15 years ago, we don't have to represent 10 years.
Absolutely.
We have to know what we are doing.
Honorable Bengize Bangane, and the Honorable Bam Gwanya to follow
by. Thank you.
Bowman will be loud last one.
Your wish has been granted. I wanted to find out, Chakasen, whether or if this legal gymnastics presentation pertains only to the Human Settlements Portfolio Committee, or it is general to
general,
all the to all the committees.
General, it's a mandate of the committee.
Right. Having said so, I'm covered about your worry about the rubber stamping. I also have had a sort of a niggly feeling about having to rubber stamp, or if that practice is reversible by any means, or if it is just something you need to follow whether you like it or not. I leave that to you to challenge. You seem to be a very good soldier for it. Then you can go ahead.
The committee, not me. The committee, not me.
No, no, you are leading the committee from that premise. Now, the other thing is, therefore, does it mean also that if, let's say, our country has not made a treaty or an agreement with, let's, for argument's sake, I will say New Zealand, and we hear of a good human settlements policy in New Zealand, does it mean, therefore, that we cannot venture into New Zealand because there are no agreements or treaties between New Zealand and South Africa?
There was a hand, I think it was the Honorable Richard, to be followed by Honorable Foreman.
I don't think Honorable Foreman makes it very difficult, man. No, I thought that the point that was raised earlier on was that there are four categories that we must look at them. And then if whatever we are doing is not within the four categories. But the point that I wanted just to raise is that whatever the example you can give, particle over the past 15 years, that is the only way we'll be able to tell us that, you know, there's something wrong that we have done in Parliament. Because I guess that there have been hundreds of churches, because the executive from time to time, they visit their cousins, their colleagues in Germany, everywhere, they find something. that the main purpose of the visit anyway to enter into a treaty for experimental changes and then for, but the point that I wanted to raise is that I think the four categories are fine. They are technically they're correct. But also given the fact that we are the overseer, surely we should understand what we are overseeing ourselves. If we wouldn't understand exactly what is it that we are overseeing, I think it would be very difficult for us even to oversee that. If the treaty aspect of things was a certain parcel of the oversight function of the committee, and then because there are executive functions and legislative functions, they differ profoundly anyway. Because sometimes I do think that is a matter that we should elaborate on from time to time. Because it's very easy for giving us anyway that the Parliament is not a supreme court now in terms of board issues, politics. The Constitutional Court becomes the supreme structure that determines everything that we do in South Africa because of the law. It's not Parliament like it used to happen. Then given all the treaties, that every treaty that is signed is subjected to our law, the existing act. But also generally, there's also national interim, there's also a constitutional court that take a final decision whether this thing is in terms of the law, the constitution, everything. But given that the human settlement area is a very broad aspect, there will be monies. In fact, I think we do have now the HDA. Surely they are going to receive monies from friendly countries or friendly donations from New Zealand, whatever. Then what should be the role of the committee in that situation? Because I think there will be some countries and there will be a lot of organs and a lot of states who may want to donate some money to the HDR.
And the social housing?
Generally, also the general, they account to us, by the department, but they account to us generally. What should be the role of the committee in that situation? Could we sit and say, now, we think HDI has, you are wrong to accept this money from an association in Canada. Can we say so if the department have already taken a decision that they will accept the donation from Habitat for Humanity, for instance? Can the committee say, no, we don't think we are right for taking this donation? Our view is that this donation, and then it's called to cause this in terms of the laws of the country and also in terms of the reputation of the country. Can we do that as a community? Because then we'll address the point that I think Manjob is raising, and then about the treaties, because generally are signed by executive.
We are
hopeful that the executive has exercised their mind before signing this matter. But can a committee really stop the executive? That's the point that I want to raise. Can the committee stop the executive from signing a treaty? Because every treaty will be given to us after it has been agreed in principle. That we have agreed in principle simply means that once we have agreed in principle, it is accepted for execution. Can we do that? That's a point that I think to me will be much more clearer. And if there's any example that we can cite, it can also be very helpful for me. Have to understand. I think it's too technically and very complex thing. I think it takes me some time to understand what we're talking about anyway. But it seems that it's a very complex thing, I accept. And then the four categories that we have assisted, I think it's going to assist us a lot to reach and sit down. But how do you see that situation?
Thank you. Thank you.
I think, Chairperson, it strikes me that we can, whilst there may be hundreds of these things floating around, I think we can only really deal with our human settlements one. And I think that this is a very good place for us to stop, and I think you've started that process now. And we can set an example. If there are other committees that have just rubber stamped, and you know the sense. But I think, and perhaps following on from my colleague here, how do we? It seems to me that we can go back if we don't want to, if we don't agree with that. We can go back and relook at that, review it. But how do we pick up? That how does the department, because the department really and the minister that are initiating these, now how do we pick up as a committee that perhaps that is just going through before it's too late, before it comes here to this committee? And perhaps that this might be something that the department needs to engage with us over rather. But that is my concern. And then those that have already gone through, I don't know if it's only these three we're talking about, but over a period of time, there might be others sitting out there that we need now. How do we recall those to make sure that we are, at this point in time, happy with those?
Thank you.
But I think we're setting an example, and I think that's really good.
Thank you very much. Chris, one?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just need to point out that it is unfortunately one area where the committee does, in respect of the technical and administrative treaties, have a rubber stamping responsibility, because the Constitution actually gives that power to the executive. The executive has the constitutional power to sign and to enter into these agreements. And
signing is another issue. No, I want us to make sure, because Parliament cannot sign. The executive signs. But before signing, we want to check what is the responsibility of the committee. The committee does not have an opportunity, not given an opportunity for consultation. I want to know, because those agreements are not just signed today. There is a process. If you look at the negotiations starts, and then there was a meeting that was scheduled at some stage to look at this agreement on the 18th of August 2009. So there was a space in between. That's the issue that we're talking about. We don't want to sign. We don't have that authority from the Constitution. But the Constitution must be clearly defined. The signing is about. But the process is, where does the committee fit in? That's it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that a lot of that, what happens pre-incoming coming to the Parliament.
We're not demanding timing.
No. I'm saying that the department may be able to enlighten us more on the process before they come to Parliament. I, of course, can only confine myself to what happens in Parliament. But I thought that I also perhaps reneged a little bit on my responsibility to say that the NA must address this committee on the processes. I think both myself and the committee secretary can guide you on process, but just in terms of how the report to the House works, that I'm not sure on. So let me just go back, because I understand the question a bit better now. The process of ratification was a question that you had asked. And where ratification is required, you have your normal committee deliberations, like you would have when you're dealing with legislation. And the committee would make a recommendation or expect reservations and all of that through your normal processes, which you normally engage in. And the reporting is normally done by the committee secretary, and that might be the format of the reporting might be a bit different to how you report on legislation. But that is what the committee's role is in the ratification. Okay. So very similar to your legislative process. Then, having said that, Section 231(1) gives the national executive the power to sign, and the department will pick up from the process before that, not the department, the executive, the national executive. In practice, I know, and they can verify that, but the president gives the minister the authorization in writing to sign. And then there was a question that distinctly said, can a committee stop the executive from signing? Those, of course, would be policy stuff, which I'm not going to venture into. And in terms of our constitution, probably the answer is no. But, I mean, politically, of course, it's a different thing. And then how do we pick up before it goes through? That we, I'll refer to the department again. And then there was a question about New Zealand and what if we don't have an agreement, can we still engage in a state visit? Yes, because then we enter into an agreement for that purpose. Then it's not an agreement that exists already whereby New Zealand is in advance agreeing to whenever we want to come. Then it's a, an agreement that we enter and doesn't have to be in writing then, you know. It's just not declared in advance, but as the need arises. And then lastly, I can... Oh, then there was one other question about have we ever done something wrong in Parliament? Those are policy decisions, you know. In terms of process, no. But in terms of content, what the government of the day agrees to. And of course, there are ways of rescinding any law that we... are now unhappy with in retrospect. And then a recommendation that I can make to the committee, my last word is that perhaps the committee can get an inventory from the National Assembly on all the international agreements that will answer your question that impacts on this committee specifically.
Okay,
thank you. Department, do you have something to say?
No. Because it's not your meeting. You are coming next week, next time. All right, okay. But then it's all open, eh? Okay, yes, because you were not invited to this meeting. I didn't have a legend and I called my mandini and one of them.
Yeah, I think we have come to the end of our discussion, but it was very much interesting. But I think really, as the portfolio committee, it is our responsibility to make sure that whatever we are doing, we must not just take things for granted. Our role would get into deeper and deeper in our mandate so that we understand it properly. And these things can be changed if we have made mistakes before, because we talk of transformation. People say, no, we just can leave it because it was like that. That is not the way we can work. We are talking of a new parliament, starting new issues, but that does not mean that we can change everything. But before changing, you have to engage, you have to deliberate, you understand, and that is the process that we are undertaking as the Portfolio Committee on Human Settlements. We don't want to just go and think as what they have. We must go to the Zabuti Siagopi, Indonesia, 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 because the children, today's children, they are asking a lot of questions to us, questions that we are unable to answer because we, our parents, that generation, by the time we were growing up, we were not asking everything, but now our children ask us. So we are public representatives here. So, it is our role to understand, knowing what are we standing for. So with those few words, I want to thank the committee and the legal unit, legal services unit, and definitely we will both, every now and again, whenever we don't understand, we'll call you, and we appreciate what you are doing to the committee. So I think we have to adjourn. The meeting is closed. Friday, 9 o'clock, ne? Colissa is reminding the department.
We have documents. Not yet.
Oh, not Mr. Gomez, hey, you are in trouble. Don't come on Friday if you don't have documents today or tomorrow. But tomorrow is just a grace. Otherwise, we're supposed to today, before the end of today, let's get the documents for Friday because it's a broad framework that we're going to engage on Friday.
So try your best. Put it, you push your muscles up.
Friday, what time?
Oh, I'm telling you, maybe.
Friday, what time?
Nice.
At the back of the house.
No, remember, you are going to receive them now.
No.
Okay.
I don't know.